Advisor K.T. McFarland. Whether McFarland met with Kislyak in July is unknown, but 5 months later she would advise Flynn during his clandestine negotiations with Kislyak over U.S. sanctions on Russia. These repeated overlaps between Gordon, Page, and Schmitz are also noteworthy. Given the trips to Hungary taken by Page and Schmitz in the summer of 2016, it's significant that Gordon, too, was a frequent visitor to that country, according to Hungarian Spectrum, which noted Gordon had a long-standing relationship with Hungarian government figures. According to an interview Gordon gave to Hungarian media outlet Mandiner, the Trump advisor visited Hungary 6 times between 2013 and 2016, most recently just after the 2016 election. Not long after Schmitz and Page returned from Hungary, GOP activist and NRA member Paul Erickson introduced Gordon to Maria Butina. The two would later attend a Styx concert together. Chapter 9. The Hunt for Her Emails. July to September 2016. Summary. Having not received any stolen Clinton dirt from Kremlin agent Joseph Mifsud when the Maltese professor first revealed to George Papadopoulos that the Kremlin had such information in April 2016, and having failed to get any such information from Kremlin agents at Trump Tower in June 2016, the Trump campaign continues nonetheless its efforts to appease the Kremlin through policy proposals and begins a clandestine effort to finally find what it has long sought, Clinton's missing emails. The facts. From July to September 2016, Trump's National Security Advisory Committee coordinates the majority of the campaign's back-channel appeasement efforts. George Papadopoulos, one of the first men appointed to Trump's National Security Advisory Committee, gives an interview with Russian media in which he underscores that Trump will eliminate sanctions on Russia if elected. Carter Page, another of the first 5 appointees to the National Security Advisory Committee, is cleared to travel to Moscow for a conference, during which he meets with both Kremlin officials and an executive from Rosneft. The Steele dossier says Trump is offered the brokerage of a 19% stake in Rosneft if the Russian sanctions are lifted when he is elected. Page fails to disclose his Kremlin and Rosneft contacts in subsequent interviews with media and even denies such meetings took place until emails show they did. He does report his activities to the Trump campaign, however. In September, Page travels to Hungary and discusses U.S.-Russia policy with several Hungarian government officials. While there, he meets with a Russian whose name he will not divulge even to Congress. During the summer of 2016, Joseph Schmitz, like Carter Page, one of the first 5 appointees to Trump's National Security Advisory Committee, travels to Hungary for unknown reasons. Whether in Hungary for this purpose or not, Schmitz is at the time engaged in an effort to track down Clinton dirt on the dark web in the form of stolen emails. He finds a trove of supposed Clinton emails from an unspecified source and takes it to a congressional committee, the FBI, and the State Department. The emails are presumed to be fake by an outside cybersecurity expert, and his request to transfer custody of the emails to the State Department and to the Inspector General for the Intelligence Community is denied. During his meetings with government officials, Schmitz says that he is working to find Clinton's emails with a client who, like him, has an ongoing security clearance from prior employment. The description of his client Schmitz provides could fit many people, one of whom is Michael Flynn, the shadow head of Trump's national security team, as he has never been formally named to Trump's National Security Advisory Committee. CNN will report in April 2018 that, in the fall of 2016, U.S. intelligence officials picked up chatter likely between Russian hackers, hoping to steal Clinton's emails and possibly get them to foreign policy adviser Michael Flynn and Trump's team through an intermediary. Of the possibility that Schmitz's unspecified dark web source for the presumptively fake Clinton emails he attempted to transfer to U.S. government officials was Russian, CNN writes, quoting Peter Clement, a retired top CIA analyst, that it is extremely plausible that Schmitz's penchant for conspiracy theories could have made him a target for various foreign influencers, including Russia. There's a lot we don't know, but Russians during the campaign were clearly targeting specific groups and parts of the country, Clement said, and Schmitz's business ties would have made him stand out. His small law firm represents a major Russian airline previously sanctioned by the U.S. State Department for arms deals with Iran. Whether working with Schmitz or not, during this period, Flynn is engaged in the very same effort as Schmitz is, seeking Clinton's emails on the dark web, in his case, with the assistance of a cutout, GOP operative Peter W. Smith. Smith receives a tranche of emails from sources he believes to be Russian hackers, but cannot get the emails authenticated. As Smith tries to recruit additional people to his cause in September, he reveals in a recruitment document that not only is he working with Michael Flynn, but also with Steve Bannon, Sam Clovis, and Kellyanne Conway. In May 2017, Smith will commit suicide in a Minnesota hotel room, leaving behind a note that says to investigators, among other things, "No foul play whatsoever." At least six members of Trump's national security team are engaged in outreach to Russian nationals during this period, with two of them also part of the effort to find Clinton's missing emails. Trump expresses his frustration with the failure thus far of the latter effort by publicly asking Russia to find and turn over Clinton's 30,000 deleted emails to American nationals. Within 24 hours, Russian hackers have begun cyber intrusions intended to find the very documents Trump requested. 3 weeks later, on August 17th, Trump receives his first classified security briefing as a presidential candidate. Less than a month before, on July 26th, top intelligence officials had determined with high confidence that the Russians were involved in the DNC breach. At his classified briefing in August, Trump is told that Russia is likely seeking to interfere with the 2016 election and indeed wants specifically to infiltrate his campaign. But there is no abatement in the Trump team's outreach to Russia. In fact, Trump becomes, in the ensuing weeks, quite publicly enamored with WikiLeaks, a non-state hostile intelligence service that has made contact with both Trump's son, September 20th, and Trump advisor Roger Stone, August 8th, and is engaged in an ongoing effort to publish reams of damaging information stolen by Russian hackers from the Democratic National Committee and the Clinton campaign. By comparison, the intelligence community is so concerned about Russian actions that CIA Director John Brennan warns Putin's FSB, his domestic intelligence service, to immediately cease all meddling in the U.S. election. The one change Trump makes after his August 17th classified briefing is that within 48 hours of being told that Russia is behind the hacking of the DNC, he fires campaign manager Paul Manafort. The reason given for the firing is that Manafort has become a distraction after the news 4 days earlier that he received secret payments from Putin allies in the Ukraine. In London, Alexander Nix, the head of Cambridge Analytica, which has been hired by the Trump campaign for its data services and at which top Trump advisor Steve Bannon had served as a vice president, reaches out to WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange to try to track down Clinton's emails. Trump's campaign is by now engaged in a three-front battle to acquire stolen materials from the Russians. Trump asks for them directly and publicly. Schmitz, Flynn, Bannon, Clovis, Conway, and once-removed Trump agent Peter W. Smith hunt for them on the dark web. And Trump's son, Don Jr., Trump's friend Roger Stone, and the Trump campaign's data firm Cambridge Analytica communicate directly with Russian hackers, Stone, or WikiLeaks, Don Jr., and Cambridge Analytica, the organization releasing the materials the Russian hackers stole. Throughout this period, a server at Russia's Alpha Bank is pinging a Trump Tower server thousands of times for reasons that are unclear. The one possible explanation is that data is being transmitted. According to computer scientists who gained access to the internet server records, 99% of all pings of Trump Tower during this period come from either Russia's Alpha Bank or a server controlled by the brother-in-law of Eric Prince, like Michael Flynn, a shadow national security advisor never formally recognized by the campaign. Russian cyber activities ramp up in other spheres as well, as Russian operatives launch a spear phishing operation on VR Systems, an election software company. Elsewhere, Russian hackers begin their attack on election systems in 21 states. Trump's then-campaign manager Paul Manafort emails an intermediary to offer Putin ally Oleg Deripaska, Manafort's former boss, clandestine briefings on the internal workings of the Trump campaign and the campaign's recent progress. This occurs 3 weeks before the FBI initiates an investigation of the hacking of the Democratic National Committee, July 25th, and then opens up a counterintelligence operation investigating covert Trump-Russia communications, July 31st. The FBI's counterintelligence operation having been prompted by a drunken George Papadopoulos telling an Australian diplomat in a London bar in May 2016 that the Russians have been peddling dirt on Clinton. At the first presidential debate, despite having received a classified national security briefing 40 days earlier stating with high confidence that the Russians were hacking Americans and American organizations with the aim of interfering in the 2016 election, Trump tells a national audience that no one knows who is doing the hacking and that it could well be somebody sitting on their bed that weighs 400 pounds. Annotated History. George Papadopoulos, one of the first men appointed to Trump's National Security Advisory Committee, gives an interview with Russian media in which he underscores that Trump will eliminate sanctions on Russia if elected. Papadopoulos's September 30, 2016 interview with Russian media outlet Interfax, which the Washington Post reported on in March 2018, was directly authorized by Trump's deputy communications director, Brian Lanza. In the interview, Papadopoulos communicated to a Russian audience that U.S. sanctions on Russia have done little more than turn Russia towards China, a statement that became the interview's headline, and unfortunately for the U.S., sanctions on Russia have resulted in massive energy deals between Russia and China. The interview came in the final 6 weeks of the presidential campaign, at a time when WikiLeaks was releasing digital materials stolen by Russian hackers and threatening to continue doing so through Election Day. In fact, according to a December 2017 CNN report, Lanza authorized Papadopoulos's media statements to a Russian audience not long after Donald Trump Jr. had received, on September 14th, an email with the website address for documents given to WikiLeaks by, as was understood at the time, Russian hackers. Carter Page, another of the first five appointees to the National Security Advisory Committee, is cleared to travel to Moscow for a conference, during which he meets with both Kremlin officials and an executive from Rosneft. The Steele dossier says Trump is offered the brokerage of a 19% stake in Rosneft if the Russian sanctions are lifted when he is elected. Page fails to disclose his Kremlin and Rosneft contacts in subsequent interviews with media and even denies such meetings took place until emails show they did. He does report his activities to the Trump campaign, however. In September, Page travels to Hungary for reasons that remain unclear. While there, he meets with a Russian whose name he will not divulge, even to Congress. In his November 2nd testimony to the House Permanent Select Committee on Intelligence, Carter Page gave evasive answers on the question of whether he'd met a Russian in Budapest during the same trip in which he met with Hungary's ambassador to the United States, Reka Samikany. Those answers include, not that I can recall. There may, at a hotel, there were a few people passing through there. I have no recollection because it was totally immaterial and nothing serious was discussed. And I vaguely recall that, you know, there may have been someone. The possibility that Page met a Russian in Budapest is of interest to congressional, FBI, and Department of Justice investigators because, as has been noted by the Hungarian Free Press, Budapest is the European headquarters of Putin's FSB. During the summer of 2016, Joseph Schmitz, like Carter Page, one of the first five appointees to Trump's National Security Advisory Committee, travels to Hungary for unknown reasons. The Guardian reported in April 2017 that U.S. allied spy agencies in France, Germany, the Netherlands, Australia, Poland, and Estonia had all told American intelligence in mid-2016 about communications between Trump campaign officials and Russian operatives. Was Budapest one of the locales for these meetings, whose number and secrecy caused John Brennan to go directly to eight senior members of Congress in late August and early September 2016? According to a May 2017 New York Times article, at the time, Brennan called the members over secure phone lines while they were on recess to tell them there was evidence that Russia was working to elect Mr. Trump president. Or perhaps Schmitz was taking the advice given by fellow Trump National Security Advisor George Papadopoulos, who wrote in an April 25, 2016 email to a senior Trump campaign official just 2 days before Trump's Mayflower speech, that if Trump were to accept Putin's open invitation to a pre-election summit, choosing a meeting place other than D.C. or Moscow would be wise because these governments tend to speak a bit more openly in neutral cities. Certainly, Brennan's intelligence and Papadopoulos's matched the information that Christopher Steele was contemporaneously recording in his 35-page dossier, which said that at least one proposed meeting between Trump's and Putin's respective agents scheduled for Moscow was moved to what was considered an operationally soft EU country when a Moscow meet was judged too compromising. According to the Association of Accredited Public Policy Advocates to the European Union, the seven countries in the EU that oppose sanctions on Russia include Italy, Greece, and Hungary, all countries that Trump's national security advisors traveled to, in some cases more than once, in 2016. Trump expresses his frustration with the failure thus far of the effort to find Clinton's missing emails by publicly asking Russia to find and turn over Clinton's 30,000 deleted emails to American nationals. Within 24 hours, Russian hackers have begun cyber intrusions intended to find the documents Trump requested. The emails in question were never found. But that didn't stop Trump advisers from pretending they had been. In a November 4, 2016 Breitbart interview, Eric Prince claimed to have learned the content of certain missing Clinton emails, even though his accounting was declared false by Clinton campaign officials and was never substantiated, even in part, by any statement from either federal law enforcement or the New York Police Department. Prince said, "Because of Wienergate and the sexting scandal, the NYPD started investigating it. Through a subpoena, through a warrant, they searched Wiener's laptop and sure enough, found those 650,000 emails. They found way more stuff than just more information pertaining to the inappropriate sexting the guy was doing. They found State Department emails. They found a lot of other really damning criminal information, including money laundering, including the fact that Hillary went to this sex island with convicted pedophile Jeffrey Epstein. Bill Clinton went there more than 20 times. Hillary Clinton went there at least 6 times. The amount of garbage that they found in these emails of criminal activity by Hillary, by her immediate circle, and even by other Democratic members of Congress was so disgusting, they gave it to the FBI, and they said, We're going to go public with this if you don't reopen the investigation and you don't do the right thing with timely indictments. I believe, I know, and this is from a very well-placed source of mine at 1PP, One Police Plaza in New York, the NYPD wanted to do a press conference announcing the warrants and the additional arrests they were making in this investigation, and they've gotten huge pushback to the point of coercion from the Justice Department, with the Justice Department threatening to charge someone that had been unrelated in the accidental heart attack death of Eric Garner almost 2 years ago. That's the level of pushback the Obama Justice Department is doing against actually seeking justice in the email and other related criminal matters. There's 5 different parts of the FBI conducting investigations into these things, with constant downdrafts from the Obama Justice Department. So in the, I hope, unlikely and very unfortunate event that Hillary Clinton is elected president, we will have a constitutional crisis that we have not seen since, I believe, 1860. Prince's false account of Clinton's emails drew heavily from Pizzagate lore. Pizzagate being a conspiracy theory that saw Clinton and several of her friends accused of running a human trafficking and pedophilia ring from the basement of pizza restaurant Comet Ping Pong in Washington, D.C. In 2016, the theory was popular among one other election-savvy group besides Trump's cadre of national security advisors, Russian propagandists. A November 2017 Rolling Stone expose found that, among others, Russian operatives manufactured the news that Hillary Clinton ran a pizza restaurant child sex ring. The magazine discovered more particularly that the claim that Hillary Clinton was a pedophile started in a Facebook post, spread to Twitter, and then went viral with the help of far-right platforms like Breitbart and InfoWars. It took the better part of a year to sift through the digital trail. We found ordinary people, online activists, bots, foreign agents, and domestic political operatives. Many of them were associates of the Trump campaign. Others had ties with Russia. In his testimony before Congress on November 30, 2017, Prince admitted to being the 4th Trump national security advisor who traveled to Hungary in 2016. Adding to the possibility, he and Schmitz were coordinating on their 2016 Clinton email hunt. Moreover, in his testimony before the House, Prince said that he met with Schmitz, a lawyer that used to work for me, twice during the 2016 campaign. Whether either of those meetings was in Hungary is unclear. Schmitz's trip to Hungary was taken right in the middle of his summer 2016 search for Clinton's deleted emails. Prince flatly refused to tell Congress when he was in Hungary. 3 weeks later, on August 17th, Trump receives his first classified security briefing as a presidential candidate. Less than a month before, on July 26th, top intelligence officials had determined with high confidence that the Russians were involved in the DNC breach. At his classified briefing in August, Trump is told that Russia is likely seeking to interfere with the 2016 election and indeed wants specifically to infiltrate his campaign. But there is no abatement in the Trump team's outreach to Russia. In fact, Trump becomes, in the ensuing weeks, quite publicly enamored with WikiLeaks, a non-state hostile intelligence service that has made contact with both Trump's son, September 20th, and Trump advisor Roger Stone, August 8th, and is engaged in an ongoing effort to publish reams of damaging information stolen by Russian hackers from the Democratic National Committee and the Clinton campaign. Trump's August 17, 2016 classified briefing irrevocably changed his legal status with respect to Russian cyber aggression. The Republican nominee was now obligated to act as a reasonable person under federal law in evaluating the likelihood that Russian actors were, as of August 2016, committing crimes against America. The federal statute that covers what is commonly known as aiding and abetting, 18 U.S.C. Section 2A, dictates that anyone who aids or abets a crime is punishable as though he had committed the crime himself. Specifically, the statute prohibits aiding, abetting, counseling, commanding, inducing, or procuring a federal crime. Because many crimes incorporate not just a planning and execution phase, but also a lengthy phase in which incriminating evidence is concealed, it's possible to aid and abet a crime after the fact by assisting the principals, those who committed the criminal act itself, in obscuring the fact of their guilt by any means, be it destruction of evidence, false statements to investigators, or obstruction of justice and witness tampering. If one doesn't have a basis to believe a third party has committed a crime, one almost certainly won't be charged for taking actions that have the inadvertent effect of aiding or abetting that crime. Just so, if one knows someone has committed a crime, but does nothing that materially aids or abets the commission or concealment of that crime, one is unlikely to be charged under this statute. If, however, one has reason to believe, under what the law calls the reasonable person standard, that there is a high likelihood a federal crime has been committed, and if one thereafter engages in behavior that a reasonable person would know was likely to have the effect of aiding or abetting a federal crime before, during, or after its commission, the statute is violated. Once Trump left his classified briefing on August 17, 2016, both he and any aide who was in the room with him during the briefing and any aide with whom he shared the classified intelligence he'd received in the briefing were immediately required to act as reasonable persons under the law and accept that there was a high likelihood Russian nationals were committing crimes against the United States. That high likelihood would be predicated on a number of facts. That Trump received a consensus judgment from one, several, or all U.S. intelligence agencies on the question of Russian interference. That those agencies, while not infallible, are known to have access to the best signals intelligence, SIGINT, human intelligence, HUMINT, and financial intelligence, FININT, in the world. That, as President of the United States, and having taken an oath of office, the reasonable person standard incorporates Trump's self-acknowledged duty to safeguard the nation. And the opportunity Trump had to question his briefers, follow up with them, receive subsequent briefings, and be apprised of their credentials. A legal assessment of Trump's responsibilities under 18 U.S.C. Section 2A might also take into account that Trump had no experience in the field of national security. A reasonable person in his position would therefore presume a high likelihood of the Russians being engaged in criminal activity, not on the basis of gut instinct or personal experience, but from the information that person had received from the U.S. intelligence community. I note here the U.S. intelligence community because Trump isn't legally entitled to rely on claims or intelligence originating from Russia in meeting the law's reasonable person standard, nor could he follow his instincts and thereby remain willfully ignorant. The aiding and abetting statute has no exception for willful ignorance. 18 U.S.C. Section 2B further prohibits any person from willfully, which the law takes to mean purposefully, causing a crime against the United States to be committed. So if by July 27, 2016, Trump had received sufficient information from his national security advisors or members of his family to believe with reasonable certainty that the Russians favored his campaign over Clinton's, were looking to assist him in securing victory on November 8th, and were engaged in an ongoing effort to illegally access emails or other materials stored in the United States, him saying what he said on July 27, 2016 would be a crime committed in public. In the context of his full remarks on July 27, 2016, it's clear that Trump was discussing and addressing, as he said at the time, Russian hackers specifically. His now infamous "Russia, if you're listening" comment immediately followed a reference to those Russians who hack into a major party and get everything. What Trump here is describing is known as computer crimes, which can involve hacking, fraud, theft, and even espionage. So Trump's invitation to those Russian cyber criminals, saying he'd find it personally interesting to see any materials Russian hackers were able to steal, and that he hoped those hackers could pull off their crimes successfully so that he and the media could see such interesting documents, was almost certainly criminal, given what Trump knew at the time. Trump's criminal intent is further underscored by the fact that his entreaty to the Russian hackers was preceded by a series of deliberate lies about his ties to Russia. Most notably, as part of his response to CNN's Jim Acosta, he said, "I have nothing to do with Putin. I've never spoken to him. I don't know anything about him." Later in the exchange, when Trump says, "If it is Russia hacking the DNC, which it's probably not, nobody knows who it is," Trump was hiding back-channel information he could well have received from his national security advisors or his own family. Specifically, in April 2016, the Russians had told one of his aides, George Papadopoulos, that they were engaged in efforts to steal Clinton's emails. And in June 2016, his son and son-in-law were told that the Russians had come into possession of official documents and information that could incriminate Clinton. Likewise, if Trump was aware of the effort being made throughout the month of July by Peter W. Smith, in conjunction, Smith claimed, with Michael Flynn, Steve Bannon, Sam Clovis, Kellyanne Conway, all top Trump advisors, to track down Russian hackers and get from them Clinton's missing emails, Trump's statement to Acosta in Florida would be untrue. Moreover, if during his August 17, 2016 classified national security briefing, his FBI and CIA briefers asked him if the Russians had made any effort to infiltrate his presidential campaign and he responded in the negative, despite what he then knew about Papadopoulos's acting as an intermediary for the Kremlin, he may have run afoul of the federal statute prohibiting making false statements to federal law enforcement officers who are in the midst of an investigation. 18 U.S.C. Section 1001. That Trump began his infamous remark in Florida by speaking about Russians hacking into a major party, but ended by asking those same hackers to find the 30,000 Clinton emails that are missing, underscores that he was aware of these hackers' past crimes and wanted them to now commit new and different ones. As noted by Quartz in July 2017, one could consider Trump's public request that Russia find and release Clinton's emails as an illegal campaign donation solicitation. This is particularly true given that Trump had spoken publicly not only on July 27, 2016, but as early as June 7, about how interesting information about Clinton's emails would be to voters and the media alike. That's a clear confirmation that, in Trump's view, derogatory information about Clinton would have cognizable value if provided to him, to the media, or to anyone else, for that matter. In July 2018, Robert Mueller indicted 12 Russian intelligence officers for their roles in hacking the Democratic National Committee and the Clinton presidential campaign. A reading of the indictment would cause one to conclude that Trump's willful attempts to induce, 18 U.S.C. Section 2A, or cause, 18 U.S.C. Section 2B, crimes against the United States by Russian hackers had been successful, just as he'd publicly said he hoped they would be, as less than 24 hours after his remarks, the very people he'd been addressing executed a cyber attack to access the very information he was requesting. Trump's August 17, 2016 security briefing, and henceforth requirement to act as a reasonable person under 18 U.S.C. Section 2, also required him to cease and desist offering the Kremlin unilateral financial benefits under the guise of a détente with the Russian government. As NBC News reported in June 2017, the Trump administration was gearing up to lift sanctions on Russia when the president took office. It was, said NBC, the latest evidence that President Trump moved to turn his favorable campaign rhetoric into concrete action when he took power. Under the reasonable person standard, Trump was required to understand that a person in his position arguing for a unilateral dropping of sanctions on Russia with no preconditions or benefits to American interests offered in return would be materially benefiting Russia, not the United States, and that such an action would be seen in those terms by Russia at a time it was expending money to commit crimes against the United States and presumably looking to offset or justify those expenditures. In April 2017, PolitiFact, the nonpartisan political and media watchdog, found that Trump mentioned WikiLeaks, which his own CIA director Mike Pompeo called a non-state hostile intelligence service, between 140 and 160 times in the final month of his presidential campaign. PolitiFact found no evidence that Trump had ever spoken disparagingly of WikiLeaks in October 2016, and indeed quoted him as saying, "I love WikiLeaks," during an October 10, 2016 speech. At the time, WikiLeaks was in the process of releasing stolen documents that, according to his August 2016 classified briefing, had a high likelihood of having been stolen by the Russians. And because Rob Goldstone had told Donald Trump Jr. that Russian actors were surreptitiously seeking dirt on Clinton, and because, per a July 2018 CNN story, Trump's attorney Michael Cohen says Trump was aware of the Goldstone-Trump Jr. emails, it's fair to say that by October 2016, Trump had reason to believe that praising WikiLeaks was likely to induce or cause both more cyber intrusions against Democratic targets and more illegal releases of the evidence stolen during those intrusions. So here, too, Trump was committing crimes in plain sight, simultaneously encouraging Russian transgressions while obscuring from U.S. voters the real state of his knowledge about Russia's actions. Chapter 10. The October Surprise. October 2016. Summary. Trump allies continue to squeeze political value out of the Clinton email issue. They push the claim that the emails contain incriminating evidence against Hillary Clinton without specifying what that incriminating evidence is. But in the weeks before the 2016 election, made up incriminating evidence in the form of a conspiracy theory called Pizzagate begins circulating on the internet, along with the suggestion that more evidence may be contained in the so-called missing Clinton emails. The widely debunked Pizzagate conspiracy theory says Clinton is running a sex trafficking ring from the basement of a pizza restaurant in the D.C. area. Rolling Stone and the New York Times report that the effort to spread that conspiracy theory is backed in part by Russian operatives and Russian-influenced networks and involves some of Trump's top advisors and surrogates, including Steve Bannon, Eric Prince, Michael Flynn, Rudy Giuliani, and Donald Trump Jr. The operation meets with unexpected success when Trump campaign disinformation about incriminating evidence, coupled with illegal leaks to the Trump camp from the NYPD and the FBI, help convince FBI Director James Comey to reopen the Clinton server investigation, which he'd previously closed, via a controversial public statement on the matter, in July. As Election Day looms, figures once thought to no longer be part of Trump's orbit reemerge. Paul Manafort is secretly advising Trump, with an emphasis, predictably, on leveraging the Clinton email issue into an Election Day victory. Roger Stone, officially gone, but never unofficially gone, from his role as a critical campaign adjunct, appears to have inside knowledge of WikiLeaks and Guccifer 2.0's intentions with respect to last-minute election interference. Campaign surrogate Rudy Giuliani darkly intimates that leaks from the NYPD and the FBI office in New York City will produce a major surprise in late October that could tip the election to Trump. Ultimately, the reopening of the Clinton case, prompted far more than is understood at the time by the collusive actions of the Trump campaign, contributes to a collapse in Clinton's support in the month before the election. The Democratic candidate goes from leading Trump by more than 7 points in a poll of polls 3 weeks before Election Day to losing the election in the Electoral College 304 to 227. Popular polling analysis website 538 will report in May 2017 that the Comey letter probably cost Clinton the election. The facts. An hour after the Access Hollywood tape is released to the public, featuring Trump bragging about serially sexually assaulting women, Trump has a secretary contact his old friend Roger Stone, the man Politico calls a political dark arts operative. Trump had fired Stone in August 2015, or, to hear Stone tell it, Stone quit at that point, but the correspondence between the two men hasn't abated as of October 2016. A fact that will eventually lead Special Counsel Mueller to assert in his July 2018 indictment of 12 Russians that Stone stayed much more involved in the pro-Trump movement after his departure than his exit from the Trump campaign proper might have suggested. He will interview at least 8 people close to Stone to try to track his movements from 2015 onward. And in late August 2018, Stone himself will take to Instagram to declare that a New Yorker source is about to falsely accuse him of telling Trump about WikiLeaks data dumps in advance. What Trump and Stone discussed immediately after the release of the Access Hollywood tape is unknown. Stone, known universally in political circles as a Nixon-era dirty trickster, according to Politico, never really disappears from the Trump campaign's milieu after his firing, in part because of his long relationship with Trump, and in part because of his even longer relationship with Paul Manafort, with whom he ran a lobbying firm in the 1980s and 1990s. According to New York Magazine, when Stone leaves the Trump campaign in August 2015, he does so, in his own words, on excellent terms, a contention that will seemingly be confirmed by his post-departure statements about his relationship with the campaign. In late August 2015, he refuses to say if he's stayed in touch with the campaign after leaving it. In September 2015, he admits that since leaving the campaign, he and Trump talk on the phone from time to time. In April 2016, he speaks glowingly of Trump's Manafort hire, noting that by turning to Paul Manafort, who's a former partner of mine, a very skilled guy, I think that Donald has made an excellent selection. The next month, in May 2016, he tells CNN that he speaks with Trump now and then. And in August 2016, as he begins to have contact with a Russian hacker and a non-state hostile intelligence service, WikiLeaks, he will tell C-SPAN, I do have access to all the right people in the Trump campaign. Weeks before Election Day, notes New York Magazine, Stone will brag about being able to fire off long memos to the Donald once or twice a week, with the expectation they will be read by the candidate. So when Stone met with a Russian national who called himself Henry Greenberg in May 2016, a meeting set up by Michael Caputo, a former advisor to Russian President Boris Yeltsin, and, in May 2016, a communications advisor to Trump, he was in a position to pass on any information he learned to the candidate himself. Greenberg, who also called himself Henry Oknyansky, offered Clinton dirt to Trump, via Stone, for $2 million, an offer Stone will say, when the meeting is finally made public in 2018, he turned down only because he knew Trump would have wanted the dirt for free. While the nature of the information Greenberg offered to Stone is as yet unknown, a clue about its topic can be gleaned from the man Greenberg showed up with when he met Stone, a Ukrainian named Alexei, who claimed he had worked for the Clinton Foundation. The 2018 revelation of the Stone-Greenberg meeting will reveal as inaccurate Stone's previous contention that I didn't talk to anybody who was identifiably Russian during the 2-year run-up to this campaign. I very definitely can't think of anybody who might have been a Russian without my knowledge. It's a canard. When asked why they withheld information about the meeting with Greenberg in their separate congressional testimonies, both Stone and Caputo will claim to have forgotten the incident entirely. Yet Caputo's alacrity in turning to Stone when his Russian business partner Sergei Petrushin comes to him with news that Greenberg has information of value for Trump underscores that in May 2016, 9 months after his firing or resignation from the Trump campaign, Stone is still felt to have ready access to Trump officials and possibly Trump himself. As the Washington Post notes, in the spring of 2016, Stone remained in touch with Trump and some in his orbit. Indeed, in April 2017, the Daily Beast will report that Stone was instrumental in convincing Trump to hire Paul Manafort in March 2016. Seen in this light, Stone's ongoing public association with WikiLeaks in the late summer and early fall of 2016 is troubling, especially when added to Trump Jr.'s late summer communication with WikiLeaks, the Kushner-hired, Bannon-founded Cambridge Analytica's outreach to WikiLeaks, and Trump's own public fixation on the organization in his October 2016 speeches. An April 2017 PolitiFact assessment will concur with a Democratic congresswoman's claim that Trump mentioned WikiLeaks approximately 160 times in the final month before the election. On August 8, 2016, Stone says at a Republican conference in Florida, "I actually have communicated with Assange. I believe the next tranche of his documents pertain to the Clinton Foundation." On August 12th, he says Assange has Clinton's missing emails, the very materials the Trump campaign has been hunting for throughout the summer of 2016. On August 21st, he claims prior knowledge of the content of WikiLeaks' next release of stolen documents, tweeting that it will soon be Podesta's time in the barrel. The fact that WikiLeaks has Clinton campaign chairman John Podesta's emails won't become public information for another 45 days. In mid-September 2016, he says in a radio interview that he expects Julian Assange and the WikiLeaks people to drop a payload of new documents on a weekly basis fairly soon. And that payload, of course, will answer the question of exactly what was erased on that Clinton email server. Amid these comments, Stone boasts of his access to Assange and is secretly in contact with one of the very hackers who is leaking stolen documents to the WikiLeaks founder. On August 14th, Stone has a back-channel exchange via Twitter with a Russian hacker, Guccifer 2.0. The next day, he tells WorldNet Daily that he has communicated with Assange and knows from these communications that information on the Clinton Foundation will soon be released by WikiLeaks. The day after that, Stone tells radio host Alex Jones that he has been having back-channel communications with WikiLeaks and knows Assange has political dynamite regarding Bill and Hillary Clinton. 2 days later, he tells C-SPAN he has an intermediary who has been acting as an interlocutor between him and Assange, and 3 days after that, he repeats the claim yet again on Glenn Beck's The Blaze radio. The intermediary Stone references is now believed to be former comedian and current radio host Randy Credico, who will be subpoenaed to testify before a grand jury by Special Counsel Mueller on August 10, 2018. Credico, a longtime Stone friend, spends much of the 2016 presidential campaign loudly denouncing Bernie Sanders as insufficiently progressive, until suddenly he declares on May 10, 2016, once it's clear that Trump will win the Republican nomination, that he is founding a Sanders Supporters for Trump group. "It is an about-face that makes no sense," Washington Monthly observes, without the further knowledge that Credico and Stone are both seasoned political operatives with a history of rat-fucking their political opponents. In this case, Sanders' primary opponent, Hillary Clinton. Despite his partnership with Stone during the presidential campaign, Credico will say in June 2018 that he will honor any subpoena sent to him by Mueller. "I'm not going to go to jail for Roger Stone," he tells CNN. While Stone retreats in late October 2016 from his prior claims of having special access to Assange, by early March 2017, he is once again claiming a back channel to Assange and asserting that Assange indeed had the goods on hashtag Crooked Hillary. When a cache of Stone's private Twitter messages is published by The Atlantic in February 2018, however, it is revealed that Stone was in fact telling the truth in the beginning. He had direct contact with WikiLeaks before and after the 2016 election. Indeed, the day after Trump's victory in November, WikiLeaks messaged Stone privately on Twitter to say, "Happy? We are now more free to communicate." Throughout all his late summer and early fall 2016 statements about WikiLeaks, Stone contends, as Trump is doing the same across three televised presidential debates, that the Russians are not behind the hack of the DNC or the Clinton campaign, calling that claim a canard. Of all his WikiLeaks tweets, Stone's October 2016 tweets on the subject of the hacked and stolen Democratic National Committee and Clinton campaign emails are particularly troubling because of their specificity and how they dovetail with Trump's concurrent campaign rhetoric praising WikiLeaks. On October 1st, Stone tweets from an account since suspended by Twitter, "Wednesday at Hillary Clinton is done. Hashtag WikiLeaks." On October 12th, Stone says he and Assange have a good mutual friend with whose assistance he has been conducting a back-channel communication with Assange. He adds that, "My friend travels back and forth from the United States to London and we talk. I had dinner with him last Monday." An August 2017 report by Foreign Policy will reveal that not only did Assange leak documents he received from the Russians, but he also declined to leak information in his possession that he apparently considered damaging to the Kremlin. Stone's foreknowledge of the release of Russia-hacked materials tracks with foreknowledge demonstrated in the last 90 days of the campaign by someone even closer to Trump than Stone, Trump's son. As The Nation explains, "A series of email exchanges, first reported by The Atlantic and then released on Twitter by Don Jr. himself, reveal that Trump Jr. queried WikiLeaks about damaging Clinton material. 'What's behind this Wednesday leak I keep reading about?' Don Jr. wrote in one exchange. After WikiLeaks emailed him asking if he would persuade his father to promote WikiLeaks via the candidate's own account, just 15 minutes later, Trump Sr. tweeted, "Very little pickup by the dishonest media of incredible information provided by WikiLeaks. So dishonest. Rigged system." This attempt to coordinate with, and indeed placate, WikiLeaks is rewarded later on in October 2016 when it becomes clear that WikiLeaks will not be releasing information damaging to Trump. Assange's political intentions will be further underscored when journalists get access to some of his private Twitter messages, which include calling Clinton a bright, well-connected, sadistic sociopath, and writing that we, WikiLeaks, believe it would be much better for GOP to win the election. On Russia, Assange will write sympathetically of the Kremlin's plight in the face of American military might. "Russia is absolutely terrified," he asserts in a Twitter direct message to a low-security internal WikiLeaks discussion group. "Kaliningrad, Crimea, and its only foreign naval base, Syria, are all under threat and are not protected by Russia's strategic depth. Consequently, the Kremlin is deeply paranoid of everyone." While Assange also levels criticisms of authoritarianism in Moscow, his focus is squarely on keeping Clinton from power, writing to his WikiLeaks discussion group after Super Tuesday of his desire that Clinton suffer a stroke. In October 2016, Stone's old business partner Manafort reemerges. It has never been clear what Manafort spends his time doing, and it is even less so during this period. Hired to organize the Republican National Convention in late March 2016, Manafort had made no effort to do so by June. According to Politico, by mid-June, less than 1 month before the convention would be gaveled in, there was no program. No celebrity acts had been booked. No known GOP leaders or elders had asked for a speaking slot. Organizers were concerned enough that they decided to bring in a new convention planner. Nevertheless, in October, Manafort contacts Trump to offer the GOP nominee pointers on how to handle the Clinton email news and urging him to make a play in Michigan, the latter being a surprisingly, perhaps suspiciously prescient remark about where Trump must focus his energies if he wants to win the election. During the presidential transition, Manafort calls Reince Priebus to counsel the administration on handling the publication of the Steele dossier by BuzzFeed. In September 2017, CNN will report that because Manafort was under an FBI wiretap for part of his time on the Trump campaign and thereafter, the fact that following Trump's inauguration, Manafort continued to talk to President Donald Trump could become problematic for the president, as those conversations occurred against a backdrop of FBI intercepts that sparked concerns among investigators that Manafort had encouraged the Russians to help with the campaign, according to three sources familiar with the investigation. In January 2018, NBC News will report that Trump believes the investigation of him can be crushed, in part because he has decided that a key witness in the Russia probe, Paul Manafort, isn't going to flip and sell him out. Trump's concern about whether Manafort might flip on him appears to grow after Manafort is convicted of 8 felonies by a Virginia jury in August 2018, and Trump's personal attorney, Michael Cohen, pleads guilty to 8 felonies on the same day, with Cohen saying during his in-court allocution that Trump personally directed him to pay hush money to multiple ex-mistresses. Shortly after the Manafort and Cohen convictions, Trump will tweet angrily about flippers, witnesses who commit crimes, then cooperate with prosecutors in later cases against their co-conspirators, referring to them as individuals for whom everything's wonderful, and then they get 10 years in jail, and they flip on whoever the next highest one is, or as high as you can go. Trump unfavorably compares flippers to his brave former campaign manager and chairman Manafort, who, unlike Cohen, refused to break. As the campaign enters its final stretch, Trump aids Russia's hackers after the fact by casting doubt on their responsibility for the attacks against America's political and voting infrastructure, despite his legal responsibility following his August 17, 2016 security briefing, not to take any action that might assist a Russian cover-up. This legal responsibility is underscored when, in July 2018, the Department of Justice indicts 12 Kremlin-backed hackers and includes in its indictments allegations that the hackers deliberately put out misinformation about who was responsible for their cyber intrusions, exactly what Trump did repeatedly after his security briefing in August 2016. Per the indictments, the indicted Russian hackers variously claimed to be American or Romanian to undermine the allegations of Russian responsibility for the intrusion. Few credited the hackers' claims at the time, giving little reason to believe their false claims affected the presidential election. However, many voters and Trump supporters appeared to believe Trump's persistent claims that Russia had not been involved in hacking U.S. persons and institutions, that the claims were made by a GOP presidential nominee who was known to be receiving classified security briefings, made them more plausible. On October 10th, in the second presidential debate, Trump picks up on an argument he made in the first presidential debate, that the DNC hacker could have been, rather than a Russian government agent, somebody sitting on their bed who weighs 400 pounds, and expands it substantially, arguing, maybe there is no hacking. 10 days later, during the third presidential debate, Trump says, 2 months removed from having been told with high confidence by the U.S. intelligence community that Russia is hacking American citizens and institutions, we have no idea whether it is Russia, China, or anybody else. Trump makes this argument even though in between the first and second debate, the FBI has announced that Russian hackers were behind cyber attacks on a contractor for Florida's election system that may have exposed the personal data of Florida voters. Even after the election, Trump's attempts to vindicate Russia from any responsibility for hacking America's infrastructure continue unabated. In January 2017, he tweets out a defense of WikiLeaks to his tens of